in this kind of strategic tug of war or push pull with China is how do you collect more of these countries that are democratic, like Australia, that have highly educated, highly technical workforces, get them inside the tent more and ease that trade and make it easier for them to access your markets and vice versa, to increase cooperation, to increase the flow of capital, to increase innovation, and to increase kind of military acquisition capabilities and technological advancements.
This is KBCast.
As a primary target for ransomware campaigns,
is security and testing and performance and scalability.
Risk and compliance.
We can actually automate that.
Take that data and use it.
Joining me today is Alex Trafton, Managing Director, National Security, Trade and Technology from Ankara. And today we're discussing opportunities for Australian companies to work with the US Defense. So Alex, thanks for joining and welcome.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I appreciate it.
With your view, now obviously your accent, you're based in the United States. So may you give us an overview of how you see the cybersecurity world from your point of view from, you know, over in the US?
Yeah, and so I actually used to live in Australia, so I am used to being told I have an accent, so I'm not taking exceptions. So I guess certainly my perspective anyway, is I tend to take a kind of a holistic view of national security and certainly for the work we do. So for me, cybersecurity fits into that, right? So we deal, you know, a great deal with basically government regulation around cybersecurity, data privacy, export controls, foreign investment. So the way I see cybersecurity is really through the lens of government regulation and how that's shaping, you know, market forces and how that's shaping cybersecurity for both government contractors and industry. And there's, you know, certainly plenty of things to talk about, but I think one thing, you know, that is clear, and I think specifically with reference to the US interaction with Australia, that there is a very clear divide in the world between what I call Team USA and Team China. And, you know, cybersecurity is a piece of that. You know, that conflict plays itself out in the cyber world. You know, from our perspective, with what we work on, the US government is waging that war with a number of tools. Some of those are trade controls around high-performing computing, AI, quantum computing, dual-use technologies, US munitions list, ITAR, military technologies, and foreign investment. So there's a regime of restricting foreign investment in the US from strategic rival nations, which is similar to FIRB in the Australian context. There's now in the US, it's called Committee on Foreign Investment in the US, CFIUS, and there's also a reverse CFIUS, which is now proposing to restrict US investment in foreign countries. So, you know, this all kind of works itself out, you know, in heightened animosity and tension, increased cyber activity, cyber threat activity from strategic rival nations, you know, like the Ukraine war has. And I think, you know, specifically in the Australian context, it kind of plays itself out with how the US engages in foreign policy and partnerships, how it chooses to share technology, how it chooses to address cyber threats and build cyber defenses. I would say that there is certainly now an enhanced enforcement and regulation push in the US. The government has issued legislation. The president has issued executive orders. Federal agencies have gone into rulemaking to further regulate cybersecurity. So there is a lot more both preventive and reactive measures that affect, you know, companies in many ways. You know, part of the national cybersecurity strategy really was to address cybersecurity at the national level through things like federal government acquisition. So we see a lot of rules around acquisition, cybersecurity performance in those contracts. We see enhanced enforcement. The Department of Justice, you know, issued its civil cyber fraud initiative, which intends to hold companies accountable and even individuals accountable for the failure to implement cybersecurity controls when under contract or in industry when they're guardians and required to safeguard personal data or company data or national security sensitive data. So it's an area, I would just say, I guess there's just an enhanced landscape of risk for companies, both from cyber threat actors and from government regulation and government enforcement of those regulations.
So you said before what the US chooses to share technologies with. So obviously you're aware of all the AUKUS initiative between Australia, US, UK.
Sure.
Do you think though, from your point of view, that people are sharing technologies, or do you think it's still sort of emerging, or what's your view on that?
I think there's competing equities, right? You know, technology controls in the international trade context exist in two places. One, with the U.S. Department of State, which manages the International Traffic in Arms Regulation, the ITAR, and with the U.S. Commerce Department, which manages the Commerce Control List and the Export Administration Regulations, or the EAR. For instance, the Commerce Department has a dual hat. It's to promote U.S. businesses abroad, but also to restrict the flow of dual-use technologies to certain restricted countries. And so there's competing equities, right? So I think there's a strong American desire for trade with our partners and with other countries. But I think at the same time, when those countries come into conflict with U.S. national security strategy or national interests, that these agencies will restrict that trade in an effort to make these countries more amenable to, you know, American foreign policy strategy, or to restrict access to critical U.S. technologies, which provides qualitative military edge, or other kind of technical advances and advantages over near peer adversaries. So it's definitely been a case of both. So at some level, the promoting trade with our partners, but also restricting trade with partners who don't kind of align as well with our national foreign policy.
So when you say restricting trade, I'm assuming you're talking about China and France, or is this across the board?
Yeah. So it can be across the board, but it's very specifically targeted at China. I mean, China, you know, the emerging rivalry between the U.S. and China is the defining rivalry of this century, the way the rivalry between the Soviet Union and the U.S. was the defining rivalry of the last half of the 20th century. So yes, I mean, I think that's definitely the objective, is to maintain both our military edge, but also our industrial edge over China, and to restrict that trade, right? Restrict access to high performance computing technologies, to semiconductors, to artificial intelligence, to stealth technology, to silent sub technology, things like that. You know, and the response from China is, you know, to close that gap, you know, to engage in intellectual property theft against U.S. companies, against U.S. defense industrial base companies, the Department of Defense itself, and also our bilateral allies who will share defense projects with us, you know, the UK, Australia, Israel, things like that. So yeah, it's a multifaceted kind of piece of strategy.
I want to come back to that, but before, because obviously there's a lot going on here, but I want to maybe now let's flip it to opportunities for Australian companies to work in the US. Obviously, I'm based here in Australia, you can tell by my accent, but a lot of people that I speak to are like, hey, sure, like, I want to go work with the US, and how do I do that? You guys have a lot more money and people, right, a lot more stuff going on. So it's more appealing to Australian companies. But, you know, I want to hear your thoughts on that before I go a bit deeper.
Sure. I think that certainly the United States has the most robust defense industrial base, which is that sector of companies which supply the Department of Defense with products and services. And I think that the U.S. would love to expand that into foreign countries to the degree that it aligns with their security objectives and their national security objectives, right? And it doesn't compromise the data and those acquisition programs that it engages contractors to provide. So as far as they're concerned, yes, they would love very much to include countries, specifically close allies, and the AUKUS agreement does, you know, specifically address the kind of intermeshing and the expansion of the defense industrial base to include Australia and, of course, the UK. You know, just the other day we had the opportunity to speak with some members of the Department of Defense, you know, both in the DoD and contractors who, you know, are engaged in bilateral negotiations and multilateral negotiations with the UK, with Israel, with Sweden, with Australia, to harmonize specifically the cybersecurity requirements that are required of U.S. defense contractors to participate in that defense industrial base. And, you know, certainly there are requirements, you know, like the DSPF or similar in Australia, the Essential Eight, you know, that too is true in the United States. We have very robust contracting requirements, certainly around cybersecurity and securing critical defense data that's not classified. So we have classified requirements, but the unclassified data as well. And so, you know, those requirements may be foreign and alien to Australian companies. And so that's where I think, you know, getting some perspective on how Department of Defense acquisitions work, and specifically the cybersecurity programs and program requirements work, is important for those contractors to understand.
Okay, operative word that you used was harmonized security requirements. So do you believe that that's hard to do? I ask this question because I've seen a lot of these little initiatives popping up and people have the right intention, but again, it's hard. People are in different time zones, different parts of the world, different cultures, etc. So how do we actually harmonize this for this to work effectively so everyone is operating, you know, in harmony?
Yeah, I think it's problematic in some ways, right? I mean, there, you know, the cybersecurity requirements, you know, to kind of conduct business as a contractor or even a subcontractor with the Department of Defense are fairly stringent. There's a requirement to implement the NIST Special Publication 800-171, which relates to the protection of confidentiality of controlled and classified information. There's obviously classified data security requirements. There are, as we mentioned, export control requirements, the ITAR, that can make trade difficult. Harmonize those and say what in these countries are they doing that can be considered equivalent? Because the U.S. is certainly not interested in lowering the standard of protecting this data in order to ensure a foreign contractor gets access to the market. I think that one of the most impactful rules that's being made now was with the Department of Defense. It's now with the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, to be a final rule and regulation and contract clause, is the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification. So previously, the United States, the DoD, had allowed companies to self-attest to the implementation of NIST Special Publication 800-171. And multiple audits and inspector general reports revealed that critical data continued to leave the defense industrial base and wind up in China, with near copies of Gen 5 fighter aircraft turning up in China. And that this self-attestation regime that they had implemented was not sufficient. They had tried several other methods, spot audits by the Department of Defense, and they weren't working. So this Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, the CMMC, is going to bring in a third-party audit regime, which would be conducted by private sector companies that are certified by something called the Cyber AB, which is a private sector nonprofit that essentially acts as a fiduciary of the Department of Defense in these audits. So I think that the negotiations with foreign countries are going to need to address those specific equities that the Department of Defense feels that self-attestation is not sufficient and that they want independent audits of that cybersecurity program that are a condition of participating in these acquisition contracts. So that may mean an equivalent program in those countries. It may mean that those countries need to stand up their own independent auditing firms, which can audit the CMMC in this Special Publication 800-171. I don't know where that lands. I do know that, you know, we've worked extensively with European and other defense contractors and that some of those projects were paused as their ministries of defense were engaged in those bilateral negotiations and multilateral negotiations. So I think the DoD is definitely interested in making that happen. I don't know with Australia specifically where they are with that, but I do know in certainly in the DSPF for Australia that this Special Publication 800-171 is one of the standards that's accepted as an ICT security standard. So certainly that is a standard that's not unfamiliar to Australians or the Australian Ministry of Defense.
So would you then also say, Alex, that this is just going to take a little bit of time before companies like Australia, you know, are meeting the standards that you've spoken about? Obviously, we don't want the US to lower their standards, etc. But when do you believe we'll get to this stage, in your words, when we right. start to see that harmony, or was this going to take a lot longer than people are sort of thinking? Because again, like these things are not, you know, we just turn them on like lights. Like, it does take a little bit of time. But I'm just curious, because again, geopolitical tensions are rising every day as we're seeing. So I'm really keen to get sort of a barometer from you.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Right now, if an Australian company is a contractor, a defense contractor to the U.S. Department of Defense, you know, these are all enforceable through contract law, right? So they'll sign a contract with the Department of Defense or with a U.S. prime contractor, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, right? And that company will then flow down these contract requirements. So currently, the risk for these companies is limited to contract law, right? Is there privity of contract with the Department of Defense? Can they enforce it, right? So, you know, is there going to be another mechanism of enforcing this? I don't know if there can be. Can there be another, more of a gating mechanism, right? You have to prove that you can do it before you can enter into the contract. That seems much more likely to me. With looking at how long it's taken for that to happen inside the United States, you know, this saga of protecting controlled and classified information, which is really the big weak spot in the defense industrial base, started in 2010 with an executive order. 13 years later, we've had a standard for 800-171 for 7 years. For four or five of those years, it was self-attestation. And this, they've been trying to make this rule applicable to U.S. companies, right? And theoretically to any Australian company that would have that contract clause for cybersecurity in it. You know, that's another 3 or 4 years of rulemaking. I mean, to then, you know, establish multilateral or bilateral agreements may be many years in the future. So for the coming years, my expectation is that there may be an audit process there, but there's still going to be exclusively contract mechanisms to enforce this. And it's probably going to be the same requirements in this special publication 800-171. I don't think the U.S. is going to adopt or accept a foreign standard because of the way U.S. law works, and that for the Defense Department must require that the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, NIST, produce their cybersecurity standards. It is a law. They cannot use ISO 27001. They can't use any other standard. They have to use those from NIST, which is a function of the U.S. Commerce Department. So I don't think that the U.S. government is going to be able to lower that standard or even change that standard. And whether there's reciprocality, it's unclear to me, you know, and there's certainly other issues at play. The same contract clause that requires companies, defense contractors, to implement 800-171 also requires them to provide forensic access to the Department of Defense in the event of a cyber incident where U.S. government data is compromised or potentially compromised. And foreign defense contractors are signing that now, but they really should be hesitating in doing, because these systems may be commingled with sovereign defense programs in the UK and Israel and Sweden and Germany and in Australia. And does the Australian government really intend to permit the US Department of Defense forensic access to potentially very sensitive Australian or, you know, whatever country it is, defense programs? And so there's other considerations just beyond the standards. So the reciprocality would include, well, can the Australian government conduct forensic? You know, can the Australian government ensure media preservation and malware sampling if malware samples are sent to the U.S. and the FBI and the NSA? So there's a lot to negotiate there. And I think that takes time. The government wheel, especially in the U.S., in Australia too, but certainly in the U.S., turns very, very, very slow.
So the timeline was 2010, now at 2023. That's 13 years. So it's probably going to be like a 20-year endeavor. I mean, obviously, like, we don't know, but...
Yeah. Yes. And it's been a very painful saga, right? And one of the, you know, initiatives that the government... So the government is, you know, at one time saying, we're going to use procurement law to require contractors to do cybersecurity. How can we force people to do cybersecurity is the question, right? You know, at the same time, they've also engaged in the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative, which... In the U.S., there's a statute, which is called the False Claims Act, that if you lie to the government to get them to buy your services, that's a false claim. And it's a very, very expensive fine, you know, that relates to the cost of the products, the number of violations. They have now begun, you know, False Claims Act, and it's a whistleblower-driven initiative, right? Because whistleblowers take home some percentage of the finding and the settlement. So the U.S. government, the Department of Justice, has been using this tool in the last 3, 4, 5 years to hold defense contractors, but other contractors, accountable for failure to implement cybersecurity, right? So there's currently risk there, right? I don't know how that would work with a foreign contractor, where the, you know, in the contract, the deciding law is going to be carried out. Is that in the U.S.? Is that in Australia, right? The other thing is the U.S., I mean, this is very interesting, and it may be tangentially related, but the U.S. government has now started, they've realized that holding you know, entities, companies accountable is only part of the equation. It's also, they're also coming after individuals. You know, I think case in point is the chief security officer at Uber. And I don't know if you track this case, but he's actually ended up in jail for lying about ransomware payments and whether those were bug bounties or whatever. And, you know, that's a major development as well in this process. And you know, giving the threat actors, the attackers, actually reduce prosecution or reduce sentencing to testify, you know, against the CSO was an interesting development, kind of tangentially related. But I think those are current enforcement mechanisms. So if we don't see an immediate resolution to bilateral agreements, we don't see an immediate resolution to an auditing standards, things like that. You know, Australian contractors who sign these, you know, Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation supplement clauses in their defense contracts, you know, are still subject to these risks, right? These false claims risks, and many others.
Okay, I want to get back just a second. You said the False Claims Act. So again, people lying to the government about capability or whatever. So give me an example of what that would look like. So are you saying someone claims, oh, we use machine learning, and they don't? Is that considered then lying to the government?
Well, I mean, I can certainly talk about the cases that have been made public, right? And there was a large case. It was the Marcus versus Aerojet Rocketdyne. And Marcus was a member of the cybersecurity team at Aerojet Rocketdyne. Aerojet Rocketdyne made large rocket engines for the U.S. government, went in, you know, missiles and space aircraft and things like that. They had been telling the U.S. government that they met the, at the time, what were the cybersecurity standards in their defense contract. So Aerojet acquired Rocketdyne in a merger. You know, Rocketdyne had some serious issues with cybersecurity, and this relator blew the whistle because they weren't listening to him, basically, about how he thought they should with respect to remediating these issues. The case settled in summary judgment, and I think they paid $9 million to the relator. The Department of Justice didn't join the case, but what they said was very interesting in a statement of interest they sent to the court. And in that statement of interest, they said that, you know, what was the false claim? And you know, it has to be made knowingly. And so how did they assume, or how did they think the company knew? And the company had incident response documentation from cyber incidents. They had pen testing reports showing that controls weren't implemented. They had internal and external audit reports. And so what they told the court was that these are material. And the question is inducement. Was the government induced under false pretenses to purchase these products? And could they prove harm? And they could prove harm because these were taken, you know, very sensitive information was exfiltrated, most likely. And the government could prove that they were harmed and that the company did so knowingly. And the threshold was so low. Right. You know, thinking about that, a pen test report, it identifies a control that wasn't implemented or was only partially implemented. And then you went to the government and said, oh, we're in compliance. And the government held that every invoice that they submitted after that time was an instance of a false claim. And it's $20,000 per instance. So if you're invoicing the government, you know, 30, 40, 50 times a month, all of those fines begin to stack up. And so I think that what that case showed was how low the bar was. Right, for the government to consider you a bad faith actor. Like, it wasn't that you lied about the existence of something. And there was just a case, another false claims case, which the DOJ also did not join, but the relator continued to press the case, was, you know, publicized, was Penn State. And they had done something very similar. They had essentially, according to the relator, this is an accusation, falsified internal cybersecurity assessment documents to improve their. There's a requirement to submit a summary score of your implementation of NIST 800-171, and that in a pinch, they falsified these documents. And that's the claim of the relator. It's not been adjudicated in court, but that's also, you know, I mean, you kind of fake an assessment, you know, that's a false claim. So the bar is really, really, really low to get in trouble. You know, there was yet another case that was related to PHI that a government contractor had two files of U.S. service members on a server that was unsecured. And they ended up paying $900,000 for that. And so the bar is just really extremely low. The question is, how do you get to the point where the Department of Justice is looking into your servers? Right? I mean, you probably have to screw up to get there. But again, the bar is very, very low.
So then I guess you mentioned before, which is why they're phasing out the self-attestation side of things, because people can't be trusted because you've just rattled off three instances where people have lied or they falsify things. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. That's really interesting. I don't get why you do that though. I understand for monetary gain. I get that. But again, you're doing cybersecurity stuff. So for me, it's more than just a job. So there has to be a level of integrity there, which is around protecting people. If you don't have any minimum sort of security compliance at all, it just really goes against your whole mission. So I don't kind of understand that.
Yeah, I think that there's when you run a company and you're judged on financial performance, there becomes a competing set of incentives, right? I mean, certainly I'm in this job and the rest of my team are in this job because one, you know, we like what we do, but also we kind of also, you know, believe that, you know, the national security of the United States is very important. And in a lot of our engagements, certainly in the foreign investment world, we operate, you know, the company pays us, but we are an oversight fiduciary of the federal agencies. And so we work on their behalf frequently to kind of hold, make sure companies are being accountable and are being and operating with integrity and credibility. And we tell everybody who will listen, the currency of the realm with the government is being a trusted partner, and that the currency is, you know, credibility, accountability, and integrity. And I think that companies, you know, in a capitalist economy are sometimes incentivized to cut corners or to view things with rose-colored glasses and to make decisions, you know, in the case of the Uber CSO, that, you know, would violate maybe my integrity, but at the time may seem like good ideas because they're judged on, I don't know, performance metrics that are different from mine potentially. And so you think about it and you go, man, that is really dumb. You shouldn't have done that. And very obviously so, but at the time, you know, people tend to have a very different opinion of what integrity might look like.
Yeah, totally understand it. And great points. So, hey, I now want to focus on Aussie companies. So you've listed, there's a fair few checks and balances. If you want to work with, like, you know, US Defense, for example, you sort of can't just roll up there and begin working, as you've clearly articulated today. But would you say now it's maybe a deterrent because it's going to, you know, to get all of these checks and balances done, that's going to cost money. And, you know, it depends on the company. If it's a big company, of course, it's different. If they're multinational, of course, it's different. But these startup companies or scale-ups.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've summarized in a pretty short sentence there the concern, not just for Australian companies, but for American companies, right? I mean, I think that's the way laws become regulation is through agency rulemaking, right? So they basically say the Defense Department shall protect our data. And then the Defense Department shall go make a rule. And these are all products of those rules, these standards we have. And, you know, in they're required to take public comments. And 80-90% of the public comments are related to cost and burden. This is very expensive. This is very hard. How do you expect us to do it? And I think that that's a very salient question, right? That how does a small company meet this requirement, right? That may even be a third tier subcontractor that no one at the DEOD even knows exists, not signed a contract with the DOD. It's still subject to the requirements. A great question. And the answer from the federal government has been very clear. We don't care. You know, on the other hand, I went to an acquisition conference for the DOD last year in San Diego, and there was three admirals and a general on stage screaming, we need small businesses and innovation to come to the U.S. defense industrial base and work with the DOD. When Bill Clinton left office, there was over 100 prime contractors, right? That those were large, you know, aerospace and defense contract companies that worked for the DOD. We're down to about 6 today. So there's just been a great deal of consolidation, and that's slowed innovation. So I think your point is exactly right. If I as a forward-thinking warfighter who has to deal with global threats that are potentially technologically sophisticated, that are extremely dangerous, and I need to keep my people alive, like, I want smart, capable, fast-moving people to produce what I use to accomplish my mission, right? Because my mission is to be fast, mobile, and quick, and, you know, all of those things. And so the DOD, you know, obviously wants these companies to be involved. And so the question is, how do they do it? And I don't think they have the answer. One, there are ways to get around, certainly, these requirements. There's what's called an OTA, which is other transaction authority, where the DoD can identify high impact technologies and things like that and kind of create a different avenue, typically for smaller businesses, to get acquisition contracts without all the burdens. And keep in mind that when you look at what's in a federal contract, and I'm sure it may be similar in Australia, but you have tons of requirements. The cybersecurity requirements are but a few of hundreds. You have requirements on, you know, a cost accounting, right? Child labor certification that you're not using child labor. You name it, it's in there. You know, is this small business owned by a minority? Is there, you know, Native Americans, right? All of those things come into play in contracting. So there's a lot there that companies have to work with. And so for smaller companies, they don't have, you know, counsel to review these things, right? So they just sign them or they avoid them. And so they are these mechanisms for the Department of Defense to engage, you know, highly mobile, highly agile tech companies. And they are definitely doing outreach in Silicon Valley and high tech places, right? And I think that's where an opportunity exists for Australian companies, right? I mean, I think that the U.S. Defense Department would be very eager to work with, you know, high speed, high tech companies from Australia. I mean, some that I've even worked with, we've worked with tech companies from Australia trying to help them get into this market, right? And, you know, great thinkers. Obviously, Australia is an incredibly technologically advanced country, well-educated population, hardworking. I mean, all the ingredients you need to be successful and productive, right? Certainly in this space. And it would be a shame if the U.S. weren't able to benefit from that, and vice versa, that the Australians weren't able to benefit from, you know, American technological innovation. And but I think that's the problem that the U.S. government needs to solve in this kind of strategic tug of war or push-pull with China, is how do you collect more of these countries that are democratic, like Australia, that have highly educated, highly technical workforces, get them inside the tent more, right? And ease that trade and make it easier for them to access your markets and vice versa, to increase cooperation, to increase the flow of capital, to increase innovation, and to increase kind of military acquisition capabilities and technological advancements.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in there I want to explore a little bit more. And just going back to your comment around the innovation, that's exactly going to be my next question. So I want to map out what's going on in my mind, because I think you agree with this theory, which is, okay, you speak about innovation. In Australia, they harp on a lot about innovation. But then, just hypothetically, it's like, oh, well, no, we can't work with you. You're too small. You haven't been around for 7 years.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, but we need to have diversity of thought. So then it's like, well, we can't do that because you're not enabling us to do that. It's gonna, because I've been around for 6 months. You may have a better solution to perhaps a larger company, but they get overlooked. And then it's like, well, the big companies just keep getting fed, and then the poor little companies are just going, this is what I've seen in the last 3 years, especially here in Australia. They're not getting the VCs that care about security companies here in Australia. The money isn't flowing here from a private equity point of view. So what does that then look like?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I mean, I've read the requirements, right? At least in the Australian legal world, to engage with the Australian defense industrial base. And it's a track record of running a business, right? They want trusted partners. Oh, we need 7 years and we need you to meet all these requirements and have these certifications and implement these standards. And you look at great technological advancements, it's three guys in their mother's garage with a GPU. I mean, like, those people aren't going to meet the criteria, right? So I think both Australia and the United States are having to balance the requirements of, you know, being a fiduciary of their citizens' data, their national security, and also, you know, getting innovative people in. I mean, what's been the result? You know, certainly there are defense focused venture capital funds in the U.S. It's a market we've tried to engage with and say, you know, how do you, you know, you can give them money, but how do you help them get access to the market if they don't already have it, right? Because that's part of the piece in the acute problem that you've described and well articulated, that they don't have access to that market, right? And I think, you know, the U.S. has solved some of that with those OTAs and other transaction authorities and ways of acquiring those systems, right? You know, but specifically in the cybersecurity space, I mean, that's another place where we need agile companies, right? We need diversity of products, you know, a good company will run two types of firewalls, not just one.
Right.
I mean, so diversity of cybersecurity tools, diversity of cybersecurity services. The DoD definitely wants more cybersecurity personnel available as both employees and contractors. So how do they get that? Right. And it's definitely an acute problem. And I don't know how they solve it, right? With kind of balancing the equities of security and fiduciary, you know, protectors, you know, fiduciaries of their citizens in terms of data protection, right? And what's one of the things that's certainly happened in the United States, and I described earlier, was that consolidation of the market. So large companies can identify these companies that may be struggling to access the market and certainly acquire, right? Or larger companies. And so what you have again is basically what's going on throughout the US economy, right? And I assume in Australia, maybe not as acute a problem, but certainly not peculiar to the US either, is large, very wealthy companies are acquiring many, many more companies. And what you have is fewer and fewer companies delivering more and more of the products and services consumed in the economy and certainly consumed by the governments. And I think that's probably a general risk. And I think it's one of the outcomes of the problem you describe is that some of these smaller companies never are able to scale before they can be acquired. And certainly the founders are incentivized to sell, you know, when they feel like they can make enough money, right? So they're not necessarily operating on the notion that I have to deliver this product, you know, as a small business to the Defense Department, that'll change the world, right? They're thinking, well, I'm getting $100 million, I'm out of here, right? And so there's lots of competing incentives, I think, is the problem.
Yeah, you're so right. And I'm seeing that every day because obviously we get the notifications as a media company into our inbox. So I'm seeing it like every day a big company goes and acquires X company. Little companies, larger, medium-sized ones. So do you think it's going to get to a stage where we just have, I don't know, I'm just going to make up a number, 20 or arbitrary number, 20 random large, big companies that have just acquired all the little companies in between? Or do you think there'll still be a balance? Or what do you think?
Well, let's take cybersecurity as an example. I mean, we see companies doing major acquisitions, right? Google bought Mandiant, right? You know, Palo Alto does acquisitions, right? You just name the security company and you see a bunch of smaller companies being acquired, you know, at least in the US, you know, for instance, the cloud market, certainly, you know, Microsoft and Azure, you know, they're very big in the defense space and they have a very impressive suite of tools. And you know, Google is trying to close that gap and they're doing so just by acquiring the capabilities and trying to patch them together. Right? So these are all companies that, you know, individually may have innovated are now, right, part of a behemoth, right? How does that end up? Yeah, I think that there is some, it's certainly the US, they have antitrust laws to break up these companies. You know, they've threatened to do that to Amazon. They've threatened to do that to Microsoft. They've threatened to do it to Google. I don't think they've used antitrust now, but I think it does create a problem for diversity of thought, certainly in the cybersecurity space, right? I mean, that is a very hot market for acquisitions. And I think I don't know if it stifles innovation, but it could.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. So then just going back on that a little bit more, what about the intention? So, I mean, I work with a lot of startups and a lot of people in the startup sphere in this country and in yours and UK, et cetera. So do you think now people are just creating security companies with the intent of, I just want to get an acquisition, like you said, $100 million, I'm out.
Sure.
So then what does that then do for our actual ecosystem if you're not building a company to change the world, in your words?
Yeah, that was I was at RSA conference in San Francisco, I don't know, 18 months ago. I go for meetings and I walk the floor to collect free shirts for the year, right? Re-up the wardrobe. And so I'm walking around, I'm seeing all of these companies and they're all like MDR companies or whatever, MDX now. And it's, you know, dynamic software scanning and statics code analysis companies. It's all just different flavors. And they're all there with venture capital money, right? And most of these companies don't make it, right? They don't even get an exit. They just kind of go away because, you know, venture capital companies are incentivized, right, to distribute risk. So they invest in 10 companies. Let's say they invest in cybersecurity sector. They invest in 10 MDR solutions or MDX or whatever they're calling it now. And they only need one of those to be a rocket success. The other nine can wither and die, and they still make enough money to kind of perpetuate their model. So you end up with a bunch of companies that may never have had really a viable product or a viable business model, but that didn't stop them from getting capital. And that was, you know, this collapse of the Silicon Valley Bank in the US, right? And I don't know if you guys track this there. This was a very serious issue. It's been a long time in the US since a bank became insolvent and the federal government had to step in. And it was a very, there was concern that would be a a broader run on the banks. I mean, that was driven a lot by this culture of incessant serial compulsive serial investing in tech companies and specifically security companies that really didn't ever deliver a lot of value. And so, you know, among other things, right? But that venture capital element that this bank served VC funds, that was their one of their main businesses. And so that was kind of a product of this culture of just, you know, compulsive serial investing in these companies. And, you know, maybe there's a few there that don't belong, you know, or more importantly, maybe there are companies that are great and they throw money at them and ignore them and never nurture them. And they end up dying when they could have been revolutionary. So I could go either way, but I think it's a challenge. You know, I don't know. I think certainly the United States is a great source of innovation, but you know, I don't know if that's an indefinite title. I don't know if champion of innovation in the world, you know, the lead innovator is going to be true forever. We certainly have other countries, you know, trying to nip at our heels. Certainly in India and the subcontinent and China, you know, parts of Europe, you know, there are other very technocratic societies now that have kind of industrialized and grown their economies and can kind of certainly start to challenge us. And I think that, circling back to my original point, that's part of, right, this new technological Cold War, is that, like, we're realizing that, you know, our massive technical gap that existed in the 80s, right, that doesn't exist as much anymore. And what are we going to do to kind of maintain our edge, right? Is it more VC money? Is it DoD gets VC money? Or is it like we deny technology to our rivals? Like, I think this all kind of comes full circle to the problem of, you know, how do we maintain our qualitative, industrial, and military edge over rival nations? And that's a collection of nations that includes, you know, what I consider Western, you know, not pejoratively, but just the way in the parlance, right? Western democracies, New Zealand, Australia, United States, Canada, Western Europe, and probably Japan and South Korea. How do we maintain those qualitative edges? And so I don't know. And I think that's a big problem. But I think these multilateral and bilateral agreements do a lot to ease the strain and lower the barriers to that cooperation and participation that's probably ultimately necessary.
Yeah, those are great points. Look, I don't know either. I think time will tell. Maybe they're going to bring a VC on the show and hear their thoughts. I remember when that's their model. They're going to buy 10 horses, you know, back all of them, but only one's going to win. So, look, I don't know. It's interesting. I think time will tell, but I want to get your thoughts on this. Just my observation as an Aussie, I was in the United States for a month last year. So in December, it was great. People are very lovely there, very nice. One of the things that was apparent is everyone in Australia here, like at least the US in day-to-day conversations, comes up multiple times a day. Not the other way around when you're in the US, Australia never mm-hmm. comes up. Now, I understand that wholeheartedly because you got everything there. So it's like as Aussie companies coming into the US, I get that. But then, you know, how do we get like reciprocity with, you know, the US thing coming into Australia? Because again, I rarely saw an Australian. I think I saw one family at Disneyland and I was there for a month. People couldn't guess my accent a lot of the time. it's just not a thing. So how does that then look coming from the other side of the coin of US companies coming here and, you know, deploying capability into Australia? And that does happen, but again, it's just probably not the first thought for a lot of these US-based companies.
I agree. It's a good question. And one, you know, right. I mean, this just kind of probably is an indicator of the solipsism of America. And I lived in Australia, right? So I appreciate what an amazing country it is and beautiful, you know, landscape, environment, people, economy. But yeah, I haven't given that so much thought, but I think that's part of the point of some of these, you know, agreements and these, you know, certainly cybersecurity cooperation agreements and military cooperation agreements, right, is to kind of build that trust and open those markets. I think with respect to American companies, it's lowering, right, the barriers to entry. Tax incentives are things that, you know, companies would look for. And you certainly have your own regime of foreign investment review, right, for, you know, we have CFIUS, you know, as these cooperation agreements grow, I think as the United States really starts to realize what a critical partner Australia is, right? Their proximity to our, you know, Eastern rivals, or Western rather, depends on how you think about it. You know, their proximity, you know, their similarity in culture and government, you know, I think those agreements tend to lower the barriers, right, to entry. And so hopefully, you know, the acquisition of U.S. and British submarines, you know, leads to vice versa U.S. investment in the Australian economy. But I don't, you know, I don't know what, like, I don't know what those numbers are, right? Like, what is like the amount of foreign investment from the U.S. into Australia now? Was 10 years ago. I don't know if it's trending flat, up or down. So I probably couldn't comment.
So is there anything specific, Alex, you'd like to leave our audience with? Any closing comments or final thoughts? I know we've covered a lot of topics today, and we could probably go on for a while, but is there anything that you'd like to leave everyone with?
Yeah. I mean, I do think Australian companies, and you're thinking selfishly as an American, you know, have a lot to offer specifically in the defense space, right? And, you know, I would encourage, you know, Australian companies, Australian defense contractors to bid on and join, right, American acquisition contracts, the Department of Defense contract. Probably don't need to urge them, right? They're probably something they're thinking about. But you know, when doing so, you know, from small to large company, making sure that they're really paying attention to the cybersecurity piece and operating in good faith when they're implementing those things is really going to reduce the risk. And you know, I think that's it. And also, you know, to be good partners, right? And I think we could all learn from that, but also being good partners when they're operating under these agreements, under export agreements, TAAs, things like that, that these companies are, you know, guardians and fiduciaries of our national security as well. And to take those kind of duties and obligations seriously. And I think, you know, that's a big one. That's counsel we give American companies all the time, frankly, but do encourage specifically Australian innovation and participation in our defense industrial base and our economy at large, because I think that the partnership between Australia and the United States is extremely critical for both countries at a time of growing both kinetic and cyber threats, and partnership, you know, spans all of those. And so I think it's a good opportunity, to your point, to grow trade, to grow, you know, bilateral economic relations and defense relations. So do absolutely encourage it.
This is KBCast, the voice of cyber.
Thanks for tuning in. For more industry-leading news and thought-provoking articles, visit kbi.media to get access today.
This episode is brought to you by Mercsec, your smarter route to security talent. Mercsec's executive search has helped enterprise organizations find the right people from around the world since 2012. Their on-demand talent acquisition team helps startups and mid-sized businesses scale faster and more efficiently. Find out more at mercsec.com today.